Lieutenant Colonel Sean Kern is a cyberspace operations officer, now a grad student in the Joint Advanced Warfighting School at Joint Forces Staff College at the National Defense University, and a former assistant professor at NDU. He and his colleague Francesca Spitalieri writing about professionalizing cybersecurity, a path to universal standards and status. And Sean, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you for joining me today. You write about this issue of cybersecurity professionalization as a people problem, and you write that it is fairly widely accepted within the cybersecurity realm that this is indeed a people problem. In what way is it a people problem, and how did we get to this point? Thank you very much for joining me, Sean.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much, Francis. Why is it a people problem? There's a number of instances over the course of the history of cybersecurity, if you will, where we've identified, this is just one example, where we've identified a number of vulnerabilities. Yet, time and time again, those vulnerabilities are exploited by the adversary. So why is that? I think there's a psychology associated with the people problem, in the sense that if I don't have to spend money against the problem, if I'm not being held accountable to that problem, then I'll spend my money elsewhere. So it's kind of a resource issue within the private sector. Because why would I spend my hard-earned money against a threat or a problem if I can spend it elsewhere until I'm held accountable? So there's kind of a psychology piece and an economics piece that happens as part of this. The technology advances. We understand how it's advancing. We have people that are futurists that consider how to anticipate these changes occurring, but we don't filter those understandings back into the workforce in a formal professional way. And so as a result, you can even find a well-intended cybersecurity workforce, a cybersecurity practitioner that is trying to keep up with the change. So it's fundamentally, and this is Francesca's, my perspective, it's a people problem. It's not a technology problem.
You write that there must be an increased focus on people, and you get at the what I call the shiny object syndrome. The predominant trend, you and Francesca write, to combat cyber risks among organizations across all sectors is to pursue the latest security tools and technology. And I always think back to Buckshot Yankee, where we had a case where somewhere in the Middle East, somebody who probably had gone through some type of cyber hygiene training took a thumb drive that he got or she got from who knows where, plugged it into the defense network, and pretty soon had infected a whole bunch of computers inside DOD and caused a fantastic, not in a good way, fantastic response. So that kind of incident says to me, yes, you're absolutely right that this is a people problem. Why do you think that message has been so difficult to get through or to get action on?
In large measure, I would offer, a friend of mine, Tony Sager, uses the phrase fog of more. And what he basically says is there's tons of options, tons of tools, plenty of knowledge, plenty of advice out there, almost too much opportunity and too much advice and too much technology for someone to make a good, rational decision about how to invest their time and resources to improve the security of the organization. So we've got this fog of more, but that fog of more doesn't always relate to better security. And so when you can professionalize it and reduce that fog of more, reduce that friction, if you will, to something that's manageable and understandable across an organization, across the workforce, and again, that's bringing that profession to the people, that's where you can kind of get at the people problem. You also kind of didn't get to it, but there's an issue here it's the common defense problem, where I've got, as a defender, have to defend everywhere. The adversary just has to find one weakness. Okay, and so typically, given the complexity and the interdependence of cyberspace generally, you have this very, and I don't see that problem necessarily going away in the near future unless we start focusing more on people and less on technology.
You and Francesca write about the workforce need and the threat to capability ratio within the workforce. How did we get to where the capability is lagging so far behind the threat landscape, Sean?
Well, there's been studies that show that over the course of the last 5 to 10 years, the STEM, people going to the STEM professions, has been decreasing. I think back to JFK and wanting to put a man on the moon, and it kind of energized the national interest, the national identity to do something amazing. And sometimes I wonder if that type of metaphor is necessary in cybersecurity because of the threat it faces to national security, public health, and safety. So you almost are looking for that that singular leader that can stand up in all this noise and make a national case for why we have to improve our cybersecurity posture across our nation, private and public sector. So I know that's kind of a far-reaching kind of idea that there would be another, you know, a JFK for cybersecurity, if you will, but something like that, or at least a concerted effort by a leading group to create that kind of message for everybody to latch on would be extraordinarily helpful.
You and Francesca write about a lack of clarity that I think may trickle down to the training and education level, Sean. You didn't go there specifically, but I kind of read it between the lines, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. You're right. Managers do not always know how to express their security needs in realistic job descriptions or assess the knowledge, skills, and abilities of potential cybersecurity candidates. As we talked about before we went on the air, it strikes me that a problem has been exacerbated the last probably 3 to 5 years by the explosion of the splintering of specialties in cyberspace.
Right.
But the fact that that hiring managers aren't really sure what skills they want to ask for, it would seem to me trickles down to the education level, because then people who are designing curricula aren't really sure what curricula they should design to prepare people adequately for these career fields. Am I on track there, do you think?
Absolutely. So I always use the American Medical Association or the Bar Association as an example, where you've got this national body that are the practitioners. They are the day-to-day professionals. And as they see their profession changing, they've got mechanisms, conduits that reach back into academia and other industry industry customers, if you will, and say, hey, oh, by the way, this is changing. This is what we need, and let's add that into the curriculum. So we don't have that for cybersecurity at large. What I would rather see is a national body of practitioners that can collect it, and I think it's what you and I call before the common body of knowledge. You're creating this common body of knowledge, these knowledge, skills, and abilities that a professional needs in that given specialty. You know, and we shouldn't get caught up on the splintering, if you will, of cybersecurity specialties. I mean, there's 128 recognized specialties within the American Medical Association. So the complexity can be managed, right? And I think it's managed by breaking it down into its constituent parts, into its constituent specialties, and letting those practitioners create the body of knowledge, create the requirements, that then go back to academia. What we're seeing right now is academia is having to try to figure out almost on their own what they think the curriculums should be. Now, there's been a great effort that's starting at the U.S. Naval Academy, where they're bringing colleges and universities together to figure out how to create accreditation criteria for their cybersecurity programs. That's a great idea. And their dean has a lot of experience with ABET, which is a recognized certification body for the applied sciences, computer sciences, and engineering. So they're looking for a way to take an existing model, ABET, and apply that to cybersecurity to create accreditation criteria. Now, I would expect that the national body and the subspecialty of those professions would inform that accreditation process in terms of requirements, and that's how you create that catch between academia and the practitioner and the professional in the field.
And that collaboration is something that you and Francesca point at further along in your work. You write, few American universities and colleges offer courses or degree programs that combine cybersecurity, technology, policy, business, and other disciplines, and even fewer encourage collaboration among departments to optimize their efforts and insights available from cross-fertilization. And I would imagine one can extrapolate further from that if you try to look at it cross-institution, one college collaborating with another college, that's probably almost non-existent, isn't it, Sean?
It is, although there are a couple of instances that are changing that. For example, there's a number of mashups, is what I call them, mashups between the colleges of engineering and the colleges of business in a number of prominent universities. So the net result is you get this leader technologist that kind of is produced by that curriculum. Because what you tend to see is a lot of people that say, well, there's really, really technical people, but they're not good at policy. And then, oh, I've got this policy expert, but they don't have enough technical expertise to develop cybersecurity policy. Where's the sweet spot? So we do find a handful of universities that are doing these mashups to kind of create that product, if you will, that student that can go out and merge those disciplines.
So you propose, along with Francesca, a proactive approach to cybersecurity workforce professionalization. The word proactive in the dictionary that lives in my head implies a very deliberate, very orderly process by which you progress to a particular end, in this case, cyber workforce professionalization. Why is it so necessary now, and what's at stake, Sean?
What's at stake? So depending on how you assess the economic impact, there's a number of studies that will suggest that anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion a year, per year, is lost to cybercrime through the theft of intellectual property, trade secrets, personal identifiable information. So you've got this economic impact that, granted, is somewhat hard to quantify given that there are limits to reporting breaches, if you will. But generally speaking, I've seen ranges of $500 billion to $1 trillion. So there's an economic piece that's absolutely critical in trying to resolve this problem.
Continuing my conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Sean Kern at the National Defense University, he and his colleague Francesca Spitalieri are writing about professionalizing cybersecurity. And Sean, you and Francesca have a recommended action plan, 6 strategic objectives. What was the process by which you narrowed it down to these 6? I imagine you considered others before you decided these were the 6 that were most critical.
You know, it was actually the easiest part of the project, to be honest. We looked at existing professional bodies and assessed what are the criteria that they use to create this professional body of experts. And the net result was there was always some function of training and education. There was usually some function of apprenticeship or internship, certification and licensure, common body of knowledge, creating what a professional needs to know, accrediting that body of knowledge through either the education or training, and then usually a code of ethics that the professional would have to ascribe to. And then, of course, there's the element in a true profession where they can actually, you know, license you to practice and then remove that license in the event that you break that code of ethics or some other reason. So we chose a very formal model that's well understood as a basis for either continuing or even as a basis for departure. You know, Francesca and I don't even begin to profess that we would fully understand the nuances of every element that would be laid into employing these, but we believe it's a good starting point, and we believe that's what's been missing.
I want to thank you and your colleague for putting pictures in this, which is helpful to somebody like me as I'm reading through it. But one of the best graphics that you have in this piece is speaks in my mind directly to strategic objective 1, and that is create an independent, nationally recognized cybersecurity professional body. And this graphic it's got 2 triangles. They're pointing at each other, one above the other, and the one that's above has the initials or names of a whole bunch of organizations that consider themselves at the present time to be an independent, nationally recognized cybersecurity professional body, who I imagine you would have to do a fair amount of convincing to get them to become involved with somebody doing that that's not them or not exclusively them, Sean.
Agreed. And there's also a handful of those bodies that do very specific things within the cybersecurity ecosystem. So not all of them are created equal. They don't all have the same level of membership. They don't all focus on the same disciplines within the cybersecurity practice, if you will. So taken together, they're a great mix. But unfortunately, it's almost like herding cats to some extent right now.
Well, and that's my fear as I look at these groups, and I'm certainly not suggesting any of these groups are obstinate on purpose, but it strikes me that it would just be a tremendous exercise in herding cats to get that many potential stakeholders to agree on something. And if one or several didn't, then I wonder if that might compromise the view that people have of the organization as the preeminent organization for for becoming this cybersecurity professional body.
It's like a very competitive market, Francis, to be honest. They all have their own equities to consider, and we have to try to, and Francesca and I have made an attempt to try to honor those equities as we suggest potential policy options going forward. So if I may, I'd like to give a specific example as a result of our report where one of those organizations in that upper triangle has actually stood up and said, hey, we believe we can develop that single central location where security professionals, you know, and their enterprises can find cybersecurity research guidance, et cetera. And it's an international organization with 115,000 members, with members in 180 countries, with 200 chapters in 80 of those countries. That's exactly the kind of footprint we would love to see this national body, and in fact, in this case, an international body, have.
Mm-hmm.
What we would prefer to see is, as their agenda moves forward, they consider the strategic objectives we identified in our report and kind of speak to each of those. So most likely what we see happening as we see an appetite for some of these organizations to raise their hand and say, we're the ones. Francesca and I are likely to start developing a feature report that may be a professionalization scorecard of some sort where we can qualitatively assess how these organizations are pursuing the objectives that we recommend.
The second strategic objective that you write about is establishing cybersecurity specialty professional associations. That gets a little bit at the splintering that I talked about in the first part of our conversation, Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it's not the proliferation is not quite as wide or wild as people seem to think it is. What's the benefit of having a network of professional associations that aren't under one roof or one framework?
Our expectation would be that you'd have that national body that would be the front man, if you will, for those member associations. So it's an ecosystem of associations, somewhat hierarchical, if you will. But each of those member associations would represent a specific cybersecurity profession. So we always look back to the NICE cybersecurity workforce framework, where they've identified 31 different cybersecurity specialties. And they didn't do that in an ivory tower in the Beltway. They went out and did a number of workshops throughout the United States, talking to academia, industry partners, to assess what knowledge, skills, and abilities are required, and then organize those KSAs under specific specialties. So what the net result of that project is 31 different specialties. So imagine 31 member associations, each member association comprised of practitioners, professionals within that specialty that are working that job, that profession day to day, that are feeding back through their member association in terms of, you know, changes and current changes, anticipated changes within the profession, and in turn that member association is feeding back to the national body in a manner that they can represent the workforce to academia, like we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's the body that would reach back to academia and say, here's what we're seeing, here's how you might need to amend your curriculum to make to be prepared to anticipate future changes in our profession. That same body would be representing itself to the U.S. government and explaining to them, here's what our professionals are seeing in the field, maybe policy issues that you may need to consider. And likewise, it's a conduit back for the government to reach back to the national body and say, here are the issues we're seeing. You know, what can you do to help fix this? And, you know, we see that in some parts. There's an organization called the Consortium for Cybersecurity Credentialing Organization, the C3. They came together specifically because the Department of Homeland Security was asking the certification ecosystem questions, and there wasn't a way to give DHS a unified voice. So the market drove these certifying organizations to come together and kind of speak with one voice, which was great, great opportunity, very glad they took that effort. But again, a single effort for a single purpose and not incorporated into a broader strategic idea.
Sean Kern of the National Defense University writing about professionalizing cybersecurity with his colleague Francesca Spitalieri. And you can find a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Your third strategic objective, Sean, it seems to fit very well with number two as far as giving the curricula developers tools to figure out exactly what they should be teaching people to prepare them for careers. It's developing and maintaining a professional common body of knowledge. And it seems having a CB CBK would make it tremendously easy for me as the leader of a cybersecurity education institution to figure out what needs to be on my agenda.
Absolutely. So the real benefit, number one, is a common body of knowledge is something that my workforce, you know, my fellows already understand. We use that nomenclature in a number of the certification regimes that we currently support. So having that common body of knowledge not only supports that accredited university, it supports any other levels of training education, because we don't want to make the case that all 31 of these specialties necessarily require the rigor of a formally defined profession. Some of these could be considered vocations, for example. And further, some of these specialties are more mature than others. Like you said, we've evolved the workforce over time. We've developed new specialties. So some of these are going to be more primed to be added into the professional ecosystem, if you will, than others. But if you don't establish an organizing construct going forward, then you're begging. You don't have the intensity. You don't have the sense of urgency, I guess, is what I'm saying we need going forward to reduce the risk to our country and to our private sector.
The fourth strategic objective is establishing and maintaining required levels of training and education. And this is a model that you say the tools already exist for. You're talking about the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology. They're kind of doing this already, and it doesn't sound like a big stretch to do it in the cyber realm.
Not at all. They're already doing it in a number of degree programs that actually feed the cybersecurity workforce already. So if they were able to carve out, if colleges were able to carve out additional curricula to support these professional specialties, ABET has the expertise. What Francesca and I haven't been able to determine exactly yet is whether we would fall in on some existing member associations that are under ABET that accredit certain specific types of programs, or whether we would recommend a separate cybersecurity member association that would be that group underneath ABET that would specifically sponsor these 31 specialties. That would be a matter of finding out what there's theory and then there's practice, right? So what would work best in practice, given ABET's longstanding as being a recognized accredited organization?
The fifth strategic objective is establishing certification and licensing requirements. There are already people in the cybersecurity area, Sean, that have letters behind their names. Are you proposing new letters or reorganization of the credentials that exist or something else?
I'm proposing new letters, and I'm proposing a consolidation of very similar letters. So there are a number of certifications, you say, that are out there. And, for example, there's the Certified Information System Security Professional, which is kind of recognized as a standard for management-level cybersecurity professionals. You also have other certifications like it that claim the same thing, that are in the same exact space. So as a HR department, how do I decide which of those are the best ones? We're asking the HR department to try to figure that out. What I'm saying is the profession should organize in a way that makes it obvious to the HR profession, this is the certification for this specific profession, hire this person. Likewise, if I'm new to the workforce and I'm trying to identify what would be the appropriate certification for me, rather than trying to look through five different types of certifications that are very similar, you know, have one for that specific specialty for me to pursue. So some new letters, because there are specialties within the NICE framework that are not currently certified, and then some existing letters that might be exist by virtue of converging to one standard.
And the sixth strategic objective that you and Francesca write about is establishing apprenticeship and residency requirements. Where are you headed there?
This really comes down to the risk that position poses to a given organization. And what I mean by that is the residency requirements, to use the medical field as an example, the residency or internship requirements for a physician assistant are significantly different than those for a full-fledged medical doctor. And why is that? Because the medical doctor represents a heightened risk to the patient as opposed to a physician assistant by virtue of their position in the organization. This would be a similar kind of thing. So again, not all 31 specialties are created equal. Some of them are going to be more amenable to an apprenticeship or internship process by virtue of the risk they pose to that organization's operations.
And the seventh and final strategic objective is establishing a standard code of ethics. That sounds pretty straightforward. Is it as straightforward as it sounds, Sean?
All of the certification organizations that currently exist require the certified member to sign off on their code of ethics, their version of a code of ethics. So it's an accepted practice within the workforce currently. Here's what's missing. In other professions, when you sign that code of ethics and you violate that code of ethics, you're no longer allowed to practice until either you've been remediated or something of that nature. In our profession, that code of ethics could be violated. You potentially could use a certification, but you'd have to be caught first. And then nothing would stop you from necessarily going and getting an equivalent certification and signing that code of ethics. So you would still be able to, quote, practice your profession. So this one would be, on the surface, easy because we understand what a code of ethics is. A number of us already signed to one. Where it becomes difficult is it's the code of ethics piece that actually makes the determination in other professions of do you practice or don't you practice. That one would be a pretty significant hurdle in the workforce right now, especially given the lack of cybersecurity professionals that we have and the number that we need.
How far, as we wrap up, Sean, are we away from being able to get to these steps? We talked about in the first part of our conversation that some of them seem to be pretty difficult to execute, but it strikes me that your goal, it may be not explicit but implicit, was to construct something that is doable and that you can make a good case to all of the stakeholders that it's something they should be involved with.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Francesca and I were kind of hedging towards a federal move in this space to create the initial foundation for action and to create a sense of urgency that might lead out, in my imagination, to about 10 years or so. And the construct that we proposed was a federally funded research and development corporation, an FFRDC, similar to the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. And what's great about that format is you've got this quasi-governmental organization that is not allowed to be in direct competition with anybody in the private sector, which represents, you know, a government sponsor, of course, and has direct links to the private sector in terms of building those relationships with the practitioners, building those relationships with academia. And then the idea would be there would be some kind of sundowner clause that says after 10 years, this thing would revert to a nonprofit third-party entity that would then serve as the national body of which we've already been developing those specialty member associations underneath. That's one model. And I think that might be the model that if you could get a Department of Homeland Security or Department of Defense or NIST to sponsor that style of FFRDC, it could be a great way to jumpstart. You've got to find appetite in the government to do that. I think it's there because NIST already has a National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, and they're already proposing a technology-oriented FFRDC for cybersecurity. But as I mentioned earlier, we're starting to see, by virtue of this increased discussion about cybersecurity professionalization, other organizations, international and national, raising their hand and said, wait a minute, you know, we believe we're postured to be that single point of contact, that centralized body that can speak for the profession. And I think so. A continued discussion and dialogue on professionalization at conferences and through research, a continued opportunity to maybe assess these organizations and provide them feedback on where we think they're strong and where we think they can still develop. That's the model and the way ahead, hopefully.